Jonathan Edwards, a preacher who lived a couple of centuries ago, had a daughter named Esther. She was married to the president of what is now Princeton University. When her husband died, she wrote, and I quote, "My loss, how shall I attempt to say how great my loss is? God only can know, and to him alone I would carry my complaint. Indeed, sir, I have lost all that I ever set my heart on in this world." Now, you might not think that just because she lost her husband, she lost everything, but that is the way she felt. She felt like she had lost all that I ever set my heart on in this world. You ever felt like that? I think that emotion is the experience of a lot of people. They might not technically have lost every last thing, but they've lost something so meaningful to them and so significant to them that that is the way they feel at the moment. What do you do when you've lost everything? How do you handle that? Well, as you know, we've been going through the book of Job, and if there was ever a man who lost everything, literally, it was Job. We've seen some of that in the opening chapters of the book, but it's not until we get to the end of the book that we hear all that he lost. What we've known so far is not all of the story. After his debate with his three friends, and after a soliloquy that he gives in Job chapter 28, he then gives a rather long speech. It covers three chapters, and that's a lot of material to cover in one three-hour sermon. You were supposed to laugh. But I want us to go through the whole thing because I think seeing this as a unit is the real message of the passage. And while we might pick out a verse or two here or there, it's seeing the whole sweep of these three chapters that is Job's real point. In other words, he was long-winded to make his point. So we're going to look tonight at Job chapter 29, 30, and 31. He does three things in these chapters, one for each chapter. So I'm going to spell out, before we look at the chapter, exactly what's going on in that chapter, and then we're going to jog our way through the chapter. In chapter 29, he is reminiscing. He is remembering all the blessings that he had before he lost everything. So, he starts out in chapter 29, verse 1, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me." So, as you can see from that verse, he's reflecting now on what was before all of this happened. And in this opening section of chapter 29, he is saying, back then I had the blessings of God. And the first blessing he mentions is God watched over me. By the way, the way this verse starts, matter of fact, I didn't begin at the beginning. It says, Job further continued his discourse and said. The fact that it says, and he continued his discourse, seems to imply that he paused to see if his friends would chime in, and they didn't, so he takes off again. At any rate, the point he's making is that before all this happened, I had the blessings of God, and one of those blessings is God watched over me. He protected me. Now, before we go to the next verse, let me point out one more thing. He said, "Oh, that I were as in months past." That's the one clue we have in all of the book as to the time frame of his calamity and suffering. It lasted for months. Years ago, I had a friend who was teaching the book of Job, And he said to me, sometimes the problem is not the severity of the suffering, it's the longevity of the suffering. That this didn't just happen and then he started getting over it. It went on and on and on. Matter of fact, I think I can identify with that. As you know, I had a spinal cord injury a little over 4 years ago. Spent 5 weeks in the in-house physical therapy at UCLA. And it's taken me years to get over the fact that laying in bed for 5 weeks lost the muscle in my legs. So I understand the longevity of the problem. But anyway, he's reminiscing, he's remembering all of his blessings in the past. He mentions guidance in verse 3. When his lamp shone upon my head, and when my light, when by his light I walked through darkness. In other words, God guided me through the darkness. In verse 4, he mentions God's counsel, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent. God counseled me and my whole household, which is what he means by tent. He had God's fellowship, verse 5, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me. He remembers the time when God was with him. I'm calling that fellowship, and all of his children were still alive. Then he talks about his material blessing in verse 6, when my steps were bathed with cream and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me. Now to understand this, you have to understand, if you have so much cream you could bathe your feet in it, you were wealthy. And so he was saying, back then I had comfort and luxury. Now that's probably a hyperbole, but the point is God had materially blessed him. So in these opening six verses, he's obviously talking about the past, and he's talking about God's blessing on his life, God's protection, guidance, counsel, fellowship, and even his material blessing. Then he discusses the fact that back then he had not only the blessing of God, but he had the respect of people. Look at verse 7. When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square. I'm sure you've heard me say before in Job and other passages in the Old Testament that the gate was city hall. If he sat at the gate, it meant he was a city official. Some indication that in that capacity he was a judge. So he enjoyed the social prestige of being a civic leader, a judge. He enjoyed their esteem and their respect. He says in verse 8, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged men arose and stood. When he passed by, the young men reverently withdrew, and the older men bowed as he passed by. The point being, he had their respect. He says in verse 9, the princes refrained from talking and put their hands to their mouth. They were silent out of respect for who he was. He was a very esteemed civic leader. The voice of the nobles were hushed and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouth. The nobles were so awed in his presence that they could not speak. And he had their approval and blessing. He says in verse 11, and when the ear heard, then it blessed me. And when the eye saw, then it approved me. So they were silent in awe, and when they did speak, they praised him. They approved him. They blessed him. So in verses 7 to 11, he's talking about the fact that because of his social position, all the social classes respected him. So he had the blessing of God and the respect of people. The next thing he talks about are all the things he did in those days. In verses 12 to 17, he says things like, I delivered the poor. Verse 12, because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the ones who had no helper. He blessed the perishing. Verse 13, the blessing of the perishing men came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. So back in those days, when I had my health and wealth and prosperity and position, I was able to deliver the poor and bless the perishing. Furthermore, he says in verse 14, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. As a judge, he wore a robe, perhaps, only he says it was a righteous robe. He judged righteously and justly. He says he guided the blind. He says, I was eyes to the blind and feet to the lame. What a vivid statement. I helped guide the blind people. I supported lame people. I protected the poor and the stranger, he says in verse 16. I was a father to the poor and searched out the case that I did not know, that meaning the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from their teeth. He pictures the wicked as wild beasts, and he says he broke their fangs and rescued victims from their teeth. So in that little section, verses 12 to 17, he's still reminiscing now about the past. And he said, I delivered the poor, I blessed the perishing, I ruled in righteousness, I guided the blind, I protected the poor and the stranger, and I rescued people who were victims. Now, the next and last thing he does in this chapter is he reflects on his thoughts. He says in verse 18, then I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. In other words, he thought, and maybe even verbalized, that he would live a long, peaceable life. He says in verse 19 that he was stable and prosperous. My root is spread out to the waters. He was stable. And dew lieth all night on my branches, making him a prosperous tree, to use his poetry. He says in verse 20, he had glory and strength. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. Verse 21, men listened to me and waited and kept silent for my counsel. Again, he is saying he had people's respect. Or in verse 22, after my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. He remembers being so respected, nobody would dispute with him. Wouldn't that be nice? He was so wise and righteous, they just accepted what he said. Verse 23, they waited for me as for the rain. They opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. Like a farmer waiting for the rain, they waited for him to speak. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my counsel they did not cast down. He was so respected, he says. If he mocked them, they wouldn't believe it was he was telling the truth. And finally, he says in verse 25, I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners. He was their guide, counselor, chief, and general. So he anticipated living a long, peaceful life and enjoy stability, prosperity, vigor, strength, and the respect of people. Now, before we look at the next chapter, I want to sum up what I've just said. The point of chapter 29 is, prior to his suffering, he was blessed by God and honored by people because of the way he treated them. May I repeat that? That's the sum of that whole chapter. Prior to his suffering, he was blessed by God and honored by people because of the way he treated them. He lived in luxury and was respected in the city by the young and the old, by princes, by nobles, because of his deeds of charity, his righteousness, and his justice. Put it rather simply, for him, those were the good old days. So that's his past. Let me make an observation. When you lose something significant, and by the way, we could add to all of this the things he's lost. He doesn't say that here, but that's obviously the case because he used to have them and now he doesn't. We could add that to all the other things he lost. But all these things were deeply significant to him. And what he did at this point is he just remembered his past blessings. Now, that's not a bad lesson for us to learn. When things aren't going well, or when you lose, maybe what you should do is just take a moment and reflect on God's blessing in the past. Not a bad thing to do. And that leads me to quickly add, that means you ought to have storing up some good memories because you're going to need them someday. Charles Dickens wrote a tale entitled The Haunted Man, which is about a chemist who had unhappy memories. The chemist asked a phantom to take away his memories, and the phantom granted his request. The memories were destroyed. The chemist got more than he requested. He not only did not have a memory, he had the power to strip others of their memory as well. The gift, however, proved to be a great disappointment. So great was the chemist's misery over his lost memories that he begged the phantom to restore his memory. At the end of this story, Dickens has the chemist saying he was grateful and prayed, "Oh God, keep my memory green." Thought that was a fascinating phrase. Memory's a good thing, provided, of course, that we have good memories. So you need to have good memories and store them up, because someday when things aren't going well, you need to remember the good old days. Psalm 103, verse 2 says, "Bless the Lord, O my soul, and forget not all his benefits." I think that's the point of Job chapter 29. In chapter 30, he shifts gears from the past to the present. Now, this chapter gets a little tricky because the first part of it needs to be interpreted in light of the last part of it. What he's really doing in this chapter is he is talking about his present emotions. But that doesn't come out until we get down to around verse 15. First of all, he's going to talk about some ill treatment he has received, and then he's going to talk about his emotions. So here's what you need to know. In chapter 29, he talked about his past blessings from God and respect from people. In chapter 30, he's talking about his current treatment and his emotional reaction to it. So we're going from past now to present. He begins this chapter by talking about who these people were that mistreated him. He says in verse 1 of chapter 30, "But now they mock me, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdain to put with dogs of my flock." Well, that's a pretty strong statement. "Whereas young men used to honor him," we just saw that in chapter 29, verse 8, "now they mock him. And to make matters worse, these young men were the sons of men who he held in less esteem than his dogs." This is the lowest conceivable point of debasement. The Orientals had no language that could express greater contempt of anyone than to call him a dog. The contempt of the most contemptible.
So he says, of all things, I used to have the honor and the respect of all classes of people, from young to old. And now, the most debased people in society mock me.
From riches to rags. He says in verse 2, indeed, the prophet is the strength of their hand to me. Indeed, I should say, what prophet is the strength of their hand to me? Their vigor has perished. Having lost their strength and vigor, they were not worthy of his attention. That's his point of verse 2. In verse 3, they have gone from want and famine, fleeing late into the wilderness, desolate and waste. They're without strength because their strength has been exhausted by hunger, poverty, and the wilderness. They're among the most miserable outcasts of society. They're among the hungry and the poverty. These are the homeless people. These are the Skid Row people. And they are mocking me. That's his point. He says in verse 4, who pluck melons by the bush and broom tree roots for their food. In other words, this is what they eat when they were in the wilderness, just describing their low state among society. In verse 5, they are driven from among men. They shout at them as a thief. They are unfit to live among the civilized, and they're a nuisance to everybody else. Verse 6, they had to live in the clefts of the valley, in caves of the earth and rocks. The whole point is they lived in that horrible, horrid valley, in these dreadful places. Among the brushes they braved, under the nestles they nestled. They lived in the bushes. They lived under the freeway. These are the people that are mocking me. I used to have the honor of everybody. Now I'm being mocked by the people that live under the freeway. They were sons of fools. Yes, the sons of vile men. Verse 8. They were scourged from the land. They are the sons of fools. We might say stupid, vile men. And they were driven out of the land. And they are the ones that are mocking me. The point of all of this is he's showing the depth to which he has sunk in the public estimation. He goes from the description of the state where he was honored, to now where he's despised by the most miserable wretches in society. Now he talks about what they did. In these opening verses, these first 8 verses, he talked about who they were. Now he's going to talk about what they did, beginning in verse 9. And now I am their taunting song. Yes, I am their byword. In other words, they made him the butt of their jokes. He was the subject of their jesting. They treated him with contempt. He says in verse 10, they abhor me. They keep far from me. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. The outcast loathed him. Wouldn't have anything to do with him. Spitting in somebody's face was the greatest insult you could give. Because he had loosed my bowstrings and afflicted me, they have cast off restraint before me. He says God loosed his bowstrings, meaning he didn't have a bow to fight with. He was defenseless, like an unstrung bow against the army of attackers. God has allowed him to be afflicted. At my right hand, the rabbles arise. They push away my feet. They rise against me, their way of destruction. Right hand was considered a place of honor. So for the rivals to be at his right hand was a great insult. Moreover, rather than show him respect, they pushed him such a way so as to destroy him. They pushed him off the road, so to speak. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They have no helper. And finally, it says in verse 14, they come as broad breakers under the ruinous storm. They roll along. They came like a besieging army against a city. The enemies of Job poured in among him as if to a breach in the wall had been made and they'd come to, well, destroy him. So, in the first part of this chapter, first 14 verses, he's talked about who they were the outcast of society, and what they did, they treated him like scum. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, the point of this chapter is to talk about how he felt at this point. So he says in verse 15, terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my honor as the wind, and my prosperity has passed like a cloud. As a result of their treatment, terror turned on Job, so he no longer felt respected or even safe. He says in verse 16, and now my soul is poured out because of my plight. The days of affliction take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night, and my growlings, pain take no rest. By great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me about as the collar of my eyes. In other words, he's just describing this excruciating pain he felt emotionally because of the way he's being treated. He says in verse 19, he has cast me into the mire. I have become like dust and ashes. Now, of course, he's talking about God at this point. God has treated him like a dust and ashes. But he says, but you, notice the you is capitalized, have become cruel to me, and the strength of your hand has opposed me. Now keep in mind, he's describing how he felt. And so given all the treatment he's receiving, he's saying something like, I've even been abandoned by God. Verse 23, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all the living. He feels like God's about to kill him. Death is appointed for everybody, and he feels like his time is up. Verse 24, surely he would not stretch out his hand against a heap of ruins if they cried out when he destroyed it. Assuming God is going to bring him to death, he says, surely in that state God would not stretch out his hand against him. Have I not wept for him who was in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? But when I looked for good, evil came upon me. And when I waited for light, then it was darkness. Now, that's why I want to do these two chapters together. You notice what he said in the previous chapter. He helped poor people. And now that he needs help, he doesn't get any. Not even from God. Do you ever feel that way? Ever feel all alone? Lost everything? No help? Worse than that, people are looking down their nose at you. He says in verse 27, my heart is in turmoil and cannot rest. My days of affliction confront me. He compares his emotions to boiling water. He is in emotional anguish. I go about mourning, but not in the sun. I stand up in the assembly and cry out for help. What he means by this, I'm mourning but not in the sun, is because of the disease his skin had become dark, but he had not been exposed to the burning sun. He stands up in the assembly and cries out for help. Now keep in mind, in the previous chapter, he was an honored member of the gate. Now he stands up in the assembly and he's crying for help. And yet he says, in verse 29, I am a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. He wails akin to the jackal and the ostrich. He's bemoaning, he's crying, he's wailing. My sin grows black and falls from me. My bones burn with fever. Apparently, because of his disease, his skin was back black and fell off, and his bones burned with fever. It sounds like an awfully excruciating physical condition. And he concludes this chapter by saying, my harp is turned to mourning and my flute to the voice of those who weep. So the instruments used to give cheerful sounds now give a sound of lamentation. So, as a result of what has happened to him, he feels terror, grief, physical pain, emotional anguish, and abandonment by God. He was without respect, disregarded, despondent. He formerly enjoyed the respect of the most respectable, and now he's experienced the contempt of the most contemptible. Wow. The outcast turned on him, and in great pain, he felt as if God was about to take his life. You know, what he's doing in this chapter is simply expressing how he feels because of all that's happened to him. So let me talk about that for just a minute. I started out by saying she felt when she lost her husband, she'd lost everything. May have not been absolutely true, but the way she felt, and I think Job did lose everything, and that's the way he felt. He lost his wealth, his children, and the support of his wife, and the support of his friends, and now the respect of the whole community, and even the support of God. I've thought about this book a lot as I've been teaching it, and it seems to me that all of this is tough stuff, but that what would you say is, of the things I just mentioned, what would you say is the toughest? Well, I might be tempted to say that one of the toughest things is losing the support of his wife. I mean, all right, so you don't lose the support of the community at large. You can live with that. You think like God's abandoned you, but you know theologically he hasn't, so maybe you could handle that. Losing your wealth is a little tougher. Losing your children is tougher than that. But it just seems to me that the one person you've got in your corner all the time is your wife, right? Well, I just want you to understand, Job lost everything. Okay? Everything. Remember his wife? Curse God and die. I think that's one of the low blows in the whole book. Some time ago, there was a man named Pepper Rogers who was head football coach at UCLA. He was going through a losing season. The media had attacked him, and the Alumni Association was calling for his resignation. His friends were becoming more scarce by the day. Nothing seemed to be going his way. Week after week, he experienced setback and defeats. Wanting some encouragement from his wife, he said to her, "My dog is my best friend, but a man needs at least two best friends." He was hinting for some encouragement from his wife. And she said, "Well, you better buy another dog." Now, I think that's the way Job felt. Lost the support of his wife. Better go buy another dog. Now, the half has not been told. Job 30 indicates that his suffering was greater than that recorded in all the chapters thus far. Somebody has said the draining encounter with his three affluent friends, it turns out, had been just one small aspect of his public ordeal. After his downfall, Job did not slip into seclusion as some of his circumstances might have done, but rather in good faith he sought help from the community, only to be fully ostracized. He did not shrink out of town. He was run out on the rail. Even the Skid Row types avoided him and mocked him in song. Wow. He's lost everything, and he reflects on the good times. And he records all of the emotional anguish that he felt. Now, in this long speech, Job does a third thing. He not only remembers the past and records how he's feeling in the present, in the next chapter, he re-examines his life. Now, the backdrop to this chapter is all those conversations with his friends. Remember, they said, your problem is you are a sinner? And in every case, he came back and said, no, you don't understand. I haven't done anything wrong. I am innocent. Well, now he lays it out. He goes back over his life and he says, no, I am innocent. For example, in chapter 31, verse 1, he said, I made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? You know, I used to be a young people speaker. I don't think I ever spoke on that verse, but that would have been a great verse, right? Somebody suggested it ought to be put on the computer of everybody addicted to porn. I made a covenant with my eyes not to lust. What a great verse. Then he says, for what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does not he see my ways and count my steps? So he is simply saying, God looks at me and he can know I did not lust. I made a covenant with my eyes and I didn't lust after women. The next thing he says about his life is that he didn't practice deceit. He says in verse 5, if I have walked with falsehood or my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales that God may know my integrity. He says, look, I did not practice falsehood. I did not practice deceit. And I'm willing to be weighed on the scales of justice to demonstrate my truthfulness and my honesty. Then he mentions covetousness. Verse 7, if my steps have turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, covetousness, or my steps adhered to my hand, then let me sow another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. If I've been covetous, then may somebody else have what I've got. Then he mentions adultery. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I've been lured by my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another and let others bow before down over her. In other words, if I've committed adultery, then may my wife become a slave. Verse 11. For that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity deserving of judgment, meaning if I had committed adultery. For those that would be a fire that consumes the destruction and would root out my increase. Well, that's vivid. Adultery is a fire that destroys a man. It utterly ruins. Then he talks about the fact that he did not mistreat his servants. Verse 13, if I had despised the cause of my male and female servants when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how will I answer? In other words, he's saying, I didn't do that. Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? He asserts, then he and his servants came from the same creator. So I did not mistreat them. I did not mistreat the unfortunate. He says, if I kept the poor from their desire or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless could not eat. But from my youth, I reared him as a father, and from my mother's womb, I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing or poor man without covering, if my heart has not blessed me and if he's not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw how I helped in the gate, then let my arm fall from my shoulder, let my arm be torn from its socket. In other words, if he had mistreated the poor and not provided for them, he says, let my arm fall off. He's pleading his innocence. He says in verse 23, "For destruction from God is a terror for me. Because of his magnificence, I cannot endure." The reason, he said, I did all this is I fear God. Then he mentions idolatry. If I have made gold my hope and said to fine gold, you are my confidence. If I have rejoiced because my wealth was great and because my hand had gained much. If I have observed the sun, S-U-N, when it shines, or the moon moving in brightness, so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an injury deserving of justice. So he is saying that he was not an idolater. By the way, that little phrase in verse 26, my mouth has kissed my hand, he's talking about bowing before an idol and throwing it a kiss, the mouth, the hand from the mouth kind of thing. But his point is, I've not been involved in idolatry, nor have I ever cursed my enemies. Verse 29, if I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hastened me, or lifted myself up when evil was found him. Indeed, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. I did not curse my enemies. I've never refused anybody hospitality. Verse 31, if the man of my tent had not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat? The men of his tent are the men who work for him. And they could never say that a stranger was not treated with hospitality. But no sojourner, verse 32, had to lodge in the street, for I opened my door to the traveler. He didn't say, I never covered up my transgressions, verse 33. For if I had covered my transgressions as Adam, by hiding my iniquity in my bosom. By the way, Adam here might be Adam, as in Genesis, and it might be a reference to all of mankind, as mankind in general covers up their transgressions. He said, I didn't do that. He gives the reason, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, so that I kept silent and did not go out the door. If I was led to hide sin in my bosom because I feared them, then let them be doomed to the total loss of their favor and become wholly the object of their scorn. I didn't do that. So he makes a plea. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my persecutor had written a book. In other words, he has presented his defense. Now he wants God to answer him as if he were in a trial. And he wants the prosecutor to write down the charges against me. I haven't seen any charges. Write them down. I want to see them because I'm innocent. I did not do anything wrong. So he says in verse 36, surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. He is confident that he would bear God's charge, the book, on his shoulder, wear it like a crown. If you wrote those down, I would gladly bear them because I haven't done anything wrong. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. Given the chance, he would present his case before God, and he would tell God every move he made. He would approach God like a confident prince. Now, he does one more thing. He goes back to listing one more thing he did. He did not misuse the land. So he says in verse 38, if my land cried out against me and my furrows wept deeply. He returns to his declaration of innocence. This time he points out that his treatment of the land, he cultivated it and he was not guilty of any injustice with it. So he says in verse 39, if I had eaten its fruit without money or caused its owner to lose lives, he's not seen the fruit of the land without paying for it. That is, without paying either for the land itself or the laborers who worked it. And finally, he says, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. He says that if he's done any injustice to the land, then let the land grow up with weeds and thistles. I'm telling you, I didn't do anything wrong.
So, it's real easy to see that in this chapter, what Job does is proclaim his innocence. He insists that he's not guilty of sins, 11 of them. The sin of lust, deceit, covetousness, idolatry, mistreating servants, mistreating the unfortunate, idolatry, cursing his enemies, inhospitality, covering up his sins, and mistreating the land. Wow! I'm saying he's reviewing his life, he's reexamining his life, and he's saying, boy, as I look at my life, I'm telling you, I'm innocent. I've been innocent toward my neighbor, that's verses 13 to 20, toward God, 24 to 34. Job's friends believed that God was punishing his sin, therefore he was a sinner. Job believed that God was punishing him when he was innocent, therefore God was unfair. He's giving the record of his entire life. He lived conscientiously. Somebody has said he was the sort of man for whom even the most mundane daily chore was done with significance, since even the smallest matter had to be handled in either a godly or ungodly way. One writer says that Job's final speech detects a consciousness that is neither proud nor abased, but simply responsible, accepting what responsibility there is. God has won his wager. God has won his wager with Satan because Job's good works, not because of Job's good works, but because of Job's good character. End of quote. Well, that's an interesting comment. All right, let me sum all this up and make an observation or two. When you lose everything, or at least feel like you've lost everything, what do you do? What are the options? Get angry? Bitter? Resentful? Spend your life complaining? Playing victim? Woe is me. Nobody's ever had it as hard as me. What do you do? Well, let me tell you what Job did. He did three things. He sat down and thought about the past, and he said, you know, in the good old days, I had a good life. God bless me. I have things to be thankful for. The second thing he did is he sat down and recorded the way he felt. That is not a bad idea. That's a good idea. Psychologists call it journaling. Then if you've complained to everybody else and they're tired of hearing your complaints, then maybe what you ought to do is just, well, journal. Write down the way you feel. Pour out your emotions. That's exactly what Job did. And then look at your life. Now, in Job's case, he looked at his life and he came out smelling good. I'm not sure we could do as well as Job, but I think the principle is the same, that when you're going through a tough time, maybe that's the time to sit down and look at your life and see how you can improve. Job looked at his life and said, I don't see anything I've done that's worthy of this, but the principle is maybe we would come to a different conclusion. But he re-examined his life, and that I submit to you is what we ought to do. In his case, he was a man of character. Do you remember what God said about Job back in chapter 1? That was so long ago we forgot, right? The Lord himself said in chapter 1, verse 8, he said this to Satan, there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. Would you like for God to say that about you? None like him on the earth. Blameless, an upright man. Well, we can be people of character.
By the way, character is not a gift, nor is it something that you obtain by doing isolated acts of what is right. Somebody has said character is something that is built up like a building through a gradual, painstaking process of placing one brick upon another. A single brick is not much, but the soundness and the careful placing of each individual brick is vital to the overall result. In the same way, faith, by its very nature, concentrates on small things, giving its energy to the responsible contemplation of one ordinary task after another. As Jesus said, whoever can be trusted with very little will also be trusted with very much. For the essential characteristic of righteousness is not sinlessness, it's rather humbly depending upon God alone for deliverance.
Could you say that you had character? The kind of character that trusts the Lord? The kind of character that, takes care of the little things.
Not just don't commit big sins, but don't commit little ones. Years ago, there was an article in USA Today that pointed out that each of us fib at least 50 times a day. The author explained that we lie about our age, our income, our accomplishments. We use lies to escape embarrassment, and we tell little white lies to protect someone else's feelings when what we're really doing is protecting ourselves. He lists common lies, including, I wasn't feeling well. I didn't want to hurt your feelings. The check's in the mail. I was just kidding. I was only trying to help. As someone has said, nothing destroys the truth faster than stretching it. And I'm simply suggesting that character goes down to little things. Ray Floyd was a professional golfer. He was ready to tap in a routine 9-inch putt when he saw the ball move ever so slightly. According to the rule book, if the ball moves, the golfer must take the penalty stroke. In this case, Floyd was among the leaders in a tournament offering a top prize of $108,000. To acknowledge that the ball move could mean that he would lose the chance for the big money. One sports writer suggested that what might have been done is that he would have started flailing his arms wildly, claiming he was being attacked by killer bees, or rubbing his eyes like a speck of dust had got in him, all the while scanning the players and the galley of any signs that the ball's movement had been detected by somebody. If the coast was clear, he would tap the ball in for a par. Ray Floyd didn't do that. He assessed himself a penalty stroke, tapped the ball in the hole, and ended up with a bogey. Now, folks, that's character. That is what Job had and what we need. No matter what or how much it cost us, or no matter how much we suffer in life, like Job, we need that kind of character down to the smallest detail. Father, help us to so walk with you and depend upon you that we have that kind of character. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.